Welcome back to A Friend Indeed, the podcast that investigates the truth about modern friendships. Today, we will be looking at the numbers of friends we have and why we have them. We'll be trying to understand why it is that some people seem to have massive friendship circles and others seem to get by with just a few close friends. But can we ever have too many friends? How does that change as we get older? And what about social media friends? Do they count? Listen on to find out more as I delve into the friends numbers game. So, I am coming to you from the darkest depths of my Facebook account. I haven't been on this in so long. Ooh, somebody's had their COVID vaccination. That's great. How many friends do they have? Let's have a look. Wow, 1,900 friends. That's a lot of friends. Oh gosh, he's had another kid? I didn't even know that. I really should come on this more often. Okay, let's keep looking. Ooh, whatever she's eating, that looks good. Hello. Oh, no friends. I can't find out how many friends she's got, although by the number of likes that's got, she's doing pretty well. In Facebook terms. Another person had their COVID vaccine. How about this person? Bet they've got loads of friends. Yeah, look, 2,500 friends on Facebook. I mean, you know, she's posting all the time, so you know. Okay, so I'm getting sucked in. So how many friends do I have on Facebook? 106. It's kind of more than I thought, actually. Who are these people? Kind of makes you feel inadequate when you kind of look at other people's friendship groups on Facebook. You know, should I be getting out there more? Should I be making more friends? But then you kind of think the opposite. I mean, like, you know, I've got 100 odd friends on Facebook, but you know, are they really friends at all? They're probably not people I contact very often. And you know, we live in a society where, obviously, depending on your security settings, anyone could find out your friendship group at the click of a button. But is that really reflective of the people we can rely on? Or do we need to redefine the notion of friendship in the age of Facebook friends and Twitter followers? You know, something in me cannot believe that anyone can really be friends with 2,000 people. To me, that just cheapens the very notion of friendship. Coming up, we're going to look at this issue, and I have an interview with an evolutionary psychologist who will be delving back millennia to try and find out why we form the number of social connections we do and how that is being shaped by the modern world. But before of that, I want us to look at a very famous number that in all my research has come up again and again. The number 150 may not mean very much to you, but it could have a very large bearing on your life. This number is known in psychological circles as Dunbar's number, and according to scientific research, it is the maximum number of friends that we are capable of having. It's named after British evolutionary psychologist Professor Robin Dunbar from the University of Oxford, and he defined this number after looking at all manner of data, including offices, communes, campsites, and Christmas card lists. And he discovered that, quite remarkably, groups of around 150 people seems to be quite consistently the limit before everything starts to kind of break down within social groups. However, this theory was published in the early 2000s. If you wind your mind back to then, none of us had a smartphone, and it was the era of Friendster and MySpace. Facebook only launched in 2004. The iPhone only emerged in 2007. So does that theory really hold water in today's world? In order to answer these questions, I've got here with me on the pod, Dr. Samuel Roberts, who is a researcher in the School of Psychology at Liverpool John Moores University. Dr. Roberts has done some brilliant research looking at how the way we communicate has been affected by modern technology. And his research delves back into our evolutionary history, looking at the parallels human social networks have with both wild and captive chimpanzees. All right, welcome, Dr. Roberts, to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. So, how many friends is normal?
It's a really interesting and hard question to start off with. So how we sort of see friendships being structured, or social relationships being structured more broadly, is if you imagine yourself sitting in a series of concentric circles, and as you move out through these circles, you feel less close to the people in those circles, and you tend to communicate at a lower frequency. And a sort of number of different studies using a number of different samples have found that there's a circle that's sort of closest to us, which we call the support group, which has a mean size of around 5 people. Typically, your closest family and then maybe a couple of close friends. There's one further out called the sympathy group, which has a mean size of around 15. And we tend to think about this as people you could turn to in a crisis. So if something really bad happens in your life, who are the people that could support you? And then there's layers beyond that, which is 50 and 150. And 150 is the sort of famous Dunbar's number. And this is the number of people you feel like you have personal relationship with.
But the number 150 is reasonably constant, isn't
it? Yeah, so that, again, that's a mean. So obviously there's variation around that, but that does include family and friends. So yeah, but that's relatively constant, it seems.
Why so few very close friends?
There's a couple of different reasons, I think. One is due to what we call constraints on the number of friends you can have. I've shown, along with my collaborators over a number of different studies, is that the relationships need maintenance if they're to survive. And that takes time, and your time is limited, and therefore your number of friends is limited. The other reason may be personal preferences, if you like. So maybe people have 5 or 15 people they feel close to. Maybe they don't feel like they need anymore because they feel they have a sort of supportive network around them. So it's quite difficult to disentangle, but certainly the time constraint does seem to be one important factor.
And how do you define, you've already mentioned a little bit how you define those close relationships of the 5 to 15 people. How could you go into that a little bit more for me?
One way we look at it is rate how emotionally close you feel to this person on a scale of 1 to 10. And we see these sort of distinct layers coming out. The other way we look at it, if you look at who you're in most frequent contact with, both face-to-face or digitally, then again, these layers tend to sort of fall out of that you're in most frequent contact with the 5 and the 15, and then much less frequent contact with the 15, 150 layers.
And is there any evidence on the type of roles that these people play in?
Yeah, so one conception of these, the importance of these friends, both from human literature and primate literature. So just to take a step back, as it were, both in my careers and in evolutionary terms, there's really good solid data on primates from a number of different species showing that primates that have a stronger social network are better at dealing with stressful events. And that's measured by things like cortisol in their urine, so sort of an objective measure. We think the same thing is true of humans. So one important role for these close groups is acting as a buffer against whatever life will throw at you, basically. And the COVID pandemic is a really good example. So if, let's say, you were not able to leave the house, or you need somebody to fetch your shopping, or just need somebody to fall back on, people with a stronger social network would expect to cope with that better because they have people to turn to.
I saw one definition was, whose death would you be upset by?
It's probably not the most sensible way of asking it. So we have used that in the past, but to be honest, now I've dropped that measure. So another way to think about it is, if you were genuinely seriously ill in hospitals, who do you think would come to see you? So, you know, I would hope my family would come to see me and maybe a couple of my close friends, but probably not my more casual acquaintances or casual work colleagues.
I'll just go back to your research. How do you know if primates are friends?
If you have, let's say, a group of chimpanzees living in the forest, the basic thing you look at is, are the association patterns between pairs of chimpanzees random, or are they different from random? But we can measure this objectively through things like grooming and who they sit next to. And again, the sort of the primates with a more stable and strong social network, they do better when stressful events happen. So one specific example that's been studied with baboons is when a new male enters a group, it's very stressful for the females because the new male will kill young infants to bring the females into estrus so he can then have his own offspring with those females. So it's very stressful. All the females show a spike in cortisol. The ones with a stronger social network, their cortisol levels drop to baseline more quickly. If something bad happens, you're stressed, but then the key question is, how quickly can you return to your sort of baseline state, basically? And both in primates and humans, the suggestion is a really important role of friendships is enabling us to get through the stressful events. And so we don't get into the state of chronic stress and chronically high cortisol levels, which can lead then to health problems.
And I guess when you're applying research like that to humans, you have to test it.
Yes. So there's been tests on humans looking at how social networks relate to health outcomes, and actually don't fully understand the mechanism, but the result is really, really clear. So one of the strongest predictors of all sorts of health outcomes, up to and including death, is the strength of your social relationships with others, basically, because you're able to better withstand the life events that all of us experience at some stage.
So are some people more likely to have greater number of friends or lesser number of friends?
Yeah, so we have looked at that in some of our research. So one of the key things we've looked at in that respect is personality. Interestingly, what we've found that across a number of different studies now is extroverts, yes, they do have larger networks, but they don't feel emotionally closer to the people in those networks. So it's almost like extroverts, they build this broad network, but they're not kind of building these really emotionally intense relationships. They have a larger network, but they're not emotionally closer to the people in their network.
So it's almost like you have a set bandwidth, and it's to you how you use that bandwidth.
Exactly, yeah. So you have, again, going back to the primate example, if a primate is living in a troop of 60 other chimpanzees and they have an hour to spend on grooming each day, how do you allocate that hour across the other 60 chimps in your troop? Do you groom for 1 minute per chimp, or do you focus more of your grooming on a smaller number of individuals to build this core network? So they have constraints on their grooming time in a similar way that we have constraints on the time that we can allocate to building these really close relationships.
And how does the number of friends we have change over time?
What we tend to see, a sort of peak of network size somewhere between kind of 20, you know, 18 to 20, 20, 25, something like that. And then as there's more restrictions and constraints on your time and ability and maybe wanting to socialize, we see a sort of smaller a reduction in network size. So things that are well established that affect people's friendship circles are entering into a new relationship. You will want to spend lots and lots of time with that partner. Often you see this kind of short-term reduction in the size of the social network, and then it kind of builds back out again as you sort of settle down. More long-lasting things that have an impact on social networks are things like children. So everyone with children, as I have, know that there are huge demand on your time. And if you're working full-time and also have relatively young children, there's not that much time or energy left over, then your social network tends to contract a little bit and probably change because you end up being friends with other parents with children because your children are hanging out together. So your networks sort of change as you go through your life.
What if you have a large family, lots of siblings or cousins?
If there's only sort of so many slots in your social network, as it were, to an extent, there does seem to be a trade-off. So in one of our studies, we showed that those with a larger family network do have slightly fewer friends. And we did do a study looking at how students' social networks changed over the course of 18 months as they moved from school to university. What we found in that study is that with friends, they need maintenance. So their old school friends, in general, they felt less close to by the end of the study. But for those friends who they kept up the contact with, they were able to maintain the level of emotional closeness. So the way I think about it is when you go off to university, you won't keep in contact with all your school friends, but you'll probably keep in contact with you know, a handful that you're really close to. With family, interestingly, we didn't see this drop off in emotional closeness. That may be because with family, you're sort of tied into a dense network where everyone knows everyone. So they kind of come for free a little bit more than friends, particularly at that kind of when you're 18. You know, you'll probably still feel close to your mum and dad, even if you don't call them very often. But you won't feel close to your friends. So I think family relationships are quite a different kind of category to friendships in that respect.
And could people move kind of in and out of the circles as well?
Yes, yeah. So if you think about these circles of 5, 15, 50 and 150, let's say for the example of students going off to university, some of the school friends who may have been in their closer layers, they won't disappear from the network completely. They will move into the outer layers. And I think one thing social media has done is made it easier to keep degree of contact about these friends in the outer layers. So I know lots of people on Facebook. I may not be in direct communication with them, but I'm kind of vaguely aware of what's going on their life because of what they post on Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is. It probably prevents them slipping off my 150 layer entirely, as it were. It just keeps that level of contact.
And of course, Dunbar's number was defined before Facebook was really a thing. So does it still have relevance now? Or are we in the age where you could actually have more than 150 friends because of social media?
As far as we can tell, it doesn't seem to have changed the sort of fundamentals of patterns of communication. One interesting thing that's come out of analysis of mobile phone data sets, which I've done, is about the last 100 phone calls you had or the last 100 texts you sent. It's going to be heavily biased towards your kind of key core contacts. So in our study, if the students moving to university, for the females in the study, 48% of all their calls were to the top three people in the network and 40% to males. So mobile phones don't seem to have changed that. And interestingly, Facebook doesn't seem to have changed that. So there's some analysis of Facebook communication by Cameron Marlowe, who works with Facebook. And what he showed is that if you look at the people with whom you've sent a message and received a message over the last 30 days, that number is relatively constant despite the number of hundreds of friends you have. So for 200, 300, 400, 500 friends, the number of people you're in reciprocated communication with only increased for something like 10 to 12.
So those people on Facebook you see with 2,000, 3,000 friends, they're not actually friends.
Yes, so what would be interesting, and it's really hard and sort of frustrating for us as researchers to get the data, because Facebook, that's how they make their money, so they're very reluctant to share their data. But from what we can see from phone calls, from what we can see from the Facebook data that is out there, yes, you know, let's say somebody has 1,000 friends on Facebook. So how many of those friends have they actually sent a message to and received a message back, or commented on their post and received a sort of response back? And it's probably going to be in the sort of tens rather than the hundreds. And again, it's kind of, that's not then constraints, because it's possible to do it, but it's more of a preference to focus our communication on these key social contacts who are the ones that are going to be important for our sort of physical and mental health.
What are you doing?
Pistachio bashing.
Yeah, get your anger out.
Okay.
Okay, so you may remember Rita from our first episode where she gave me a friend appraisal. You would visit me in the hospital, right?
Let's not even think about that.
Yeah, let's not think about that. That's horrible. Okay, so fess up. How many friends do you have on Facebook?
I don't know, 50?
I'm going to look it up. So you have 234 friends.
Oh, God.
Is that more or less than you thought?
Well, obviously, it's a lot more. I thought I had about 50.
Well, according to our interviewee, you have, you know, about 80 more friends on Facebook than is required.
Oh, well, I'm just going to have to go and call them all then when I'm off the boat.
That is an option.
Oh my God, that was not even discussed.
Well, it was about people dropping out of your circle. So obviously on Facebook, that's the interesting thing. I suppose they stay there, don't they? You never like cull people on Facebook unless you're really mean.
That's true. And actually on Facebook, you would actually have to actively delete someone, which is not true to reality.
I found everything actually from the interview strangely reassuring.
But reassuring in what way?
That, you know, there's different ways of doing friendship. You can have a massive friendship group and not spend a lot of time or invest a lot of energy into your friends if that's what you want, although they might not be there for you when you really need them. Or you can choose the other route and have a smaller pool of friends that you invest a lot more in, I think.
Yeah. But also, I think you probably can get people that on Facebook have thousands of friends, but actually might still in reality be introverts.
But it's interesting. It's interesting the kind of, because he was approaching it from an evolutionary perspective. And of course, I think you could kind of draw parallels quite glibly, I suppose. But he wasn't doing that at all. He was kind of more saying, you know, that we're making these connections almost unconsciously because it's something deep within you knows it's a good thing to do.
But what's interesting to think about on that level, our ability to sort of form and make relationships, that probably also comes and has a model from very early on. So if we have a lot of family breakdowns, like relationship breakdowns in our families, then actually that makes it a lot harder for us to have seen a model of like how relationships can be formed and held. I suppose what I'm thinking is how much of that statistic, it's probably not just however many friends we have means that we will have less likelihood to have heart failure or whatever early, or whatever it might be, a heart disease or whatever, but it's probably also something about all of our experiences cumulatively from a very young age and how that's also shaped our ability to manage relationships or have healthy relationships.
Yeah, because a lot of the definitions he was using were, you know, how close do you feel to this person, would this person visit you in hospital, how often do you contact this person, but I don't know whether those measures are always a measure of quality in terms of that relationship.
But I suppose, I mean, you know, as a general indicator, I mean, it's, you know, when someone is in hospital and there's no one that goes to visit them, then that's usually an indicator of either that they haven't told anyone, which I suppose says something in itself, or also that they're quite isolated.
I do find it quite weird that people have like kids or get married or something and they put something on Facebook and that's like an announcement, and I'm like, I completely miss it because I have no idea. And then you maybe go to Facebook once a year like I do, and then you're like, oh, they're married and they have two kids. I really didn't know any of that.
Well, that's the thing, like I can imagine I would be seen as really antisocial, you know, because our photographer put on our picture of our wedding, and that's like, suddenly it's like this photo comes up of our wedding. Also, before, you know, I remember growing up, for example, I would see the whole film footage of like maybe 4 hours worth of film footage of like weddings that happened, yeah, in the family. And then my mum would be like, this is so-and-so, this is so-and-so, that's so-and-so, this is your aunt, this is second cousin, this is your blah, 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 this is your dad, you know. And the CD would be given to everybody. And I was thinking it was probably also seen as really bad when you don't put your photos now on Facebook to share. But it feels, I was sort of like, who's going to want to see that? You know, like, who's going to want to watch that one?
It was what he was saying in the interview, that you've got that point of reference now, so you can go to them and be, you know, have some frame of reference for what's going on in their lives. Whereas with you, because you're not on Facebook posting anything, people don't have that with you. So you might actually be losing out because those people wouldn't come up to you because they wouldn't have anything to say.
Oh, I would be. I'm obsolete.
Oh, well, wouldn't go that far, Rita. Well, on that joyous note, I've got to wrap this up. Thank you, Rita. And I'm sure you'll be back to another when we do another podcast.
I'll be back, Ardy. Bye.
Well, that's it for the episode today. Thank you to Dr. Samuel Roberts for coming on and giving us such an interesting interview. If you do want to get in touch with us, then we're on Instagram at @a_friendindeed, or get in touch by email at friendindeedpod@gmail.com. Until the next time, bye-bye.